Is it rolling, Bob? As Johnny Cash said.
Hello! Acoustically, this RMSYL covers all the bases. You've got Nick Pohl. For some reason, I always want to say Nick Cave, and maybe he has actually got a bit of the Nick Cave about him. But also a bit of Elvis. So, vocally, he can go really basso profundo, which suits this Carver poem. And then you've got me, who often gets asked on the phone whether Madam would mind holding the line while the receptionist sees if Mr. Fitzgerald is able to take my call. So you're getting, well, Shanana here, I suppose, without the doo-wop. Nick doing Bowser, me doing Johnny. Enjoy. So this evening I'm here with Nick Pohl, a mind-body therapist and teacher. Quite a tired Nick Pohl, who's just told me that he got up this morning at 4 a.m.
I did.
Do you feel as tired as you look, Nick?
Probably. Yeah.
Okay.
But I think that might help in this case.
Well, why do you think being tired could be helpful for Raymond Carver's What the Doctor Said?
Well, this poem is about being told that you're going to be dying soon. And I think that Raymond Carver probably knew already what the doctor was going to tell him. And a certain tiredness of the soul may be possibly heard in the poem. It just takes, and it brings, I think when you got up at 4 a.m, it gives a certain edge to one's experience of reality, which is often quite welcome. It takes that nervous edge off, and it just makes you a bit closer to what's really going on. Sometimes.
You have actually learnt the poem. I remember you sent me an email and you were not, I'm not saying it was a sort of a showing off email, but you said, because I've told you that I've been learning poems, yeah, and it takes me about a week to learn a poem, and you said, yeah, I learnt it quite quickly.
No, I was surprised that this one, yes.
How quickly did it manage to take root in your head?
I don't remember, but pretty quickly. And I think it's because...
What is pretty quickly?
It's a conversational... The whole poem is couched as a conversation. Mm. That may have helped. But I've learned another one since, and that came in quite well as well, quite quickly.
So maybe you just have a better brain for learning poetry, because it's really slow for me.
Okay.
Which is neither good nor bad necessarily, yeah. But like anyone who finds something slow, when I see someone doing this thing I value very quickly, I have admiration, possibly even jealousy for it.
Excellent. Now I was surprised when you said it was taking you a long time to learn the one that I wrote, because it's only 5 lines or something. And I immediately went up and learned it myself in pretty short order.
Yes. Shall I try that one? I'm not going to necessarily include it. Shall I see if I can remember? Because seeing as you're going to recite it, so it seems only fair that I try and remember your poem. So, okay, this is Nick's poem. This paper speaks volumes in being so white. As if to lay a single word there, however carefully or prayerfully, would be a sacrilege, a sacrifice. What am I to do? How can I say this without my pen?
What can I do?
What can I do? What did I say?
What am I to do?
What am I to do?
Yeah.
It's you see, I have a mind that just wants to sort of warp other people's words to my own needs.
But isn't that okay? We all need to say poems in our own way.
It is okay.
In some ways, yeah.
It is okay. And the great Kim Rosen, as I shall now refer to her, she says it's okay, but it's also really, really good to take note of where you do veer off, and also the lines that you forget,
because those are quite, there's some lesson to be learned there. So, you know, if you were to analyse, if we were to talk about, which we're not going to, why I said, how am I to do this, as opposed to how can I do this, there's probably a reason why my brain wanted to do it that way, as opposed to your way. So anyway, that was my little recitation there. And how are you feeling about reciting? Are you going to try and recite the carver?
Yeah.
Well, I'd love it if you could. That would be great. I mean, keep it in your paper in your hand if you like.
He said, "It doesn't look good." He said, "It looks bad. In fact, real bad." He said, "I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting." I said, "I'm glad. I wouldn't want to know about there being any more than that." He said, "Are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help? When you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms, do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments?" I said, "Not yet, but I intend to start today." He said, "I'm real sorry," he said. "I wish I had some other kind of news to give you." I said, "Amen." And he said something else I didn't catch, and not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, and me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back, and it was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, habit being so strong.
I mean, it's really interesting hearing the poem, because the first three quarters you recited, and then probably because you got up at 4 o'clock this morning, needed to check the last part and read the last part. And it, I don't know how it felt for you, but it, the last quarter, it wasn't the same being read. There was a depth to when those words were coming from the depths, as to when they were being read off the page. I mean, did it feel different when you were reading as opposed to reciting? Because you did a bit of both.
Well, I still feel I'm rehearsing, really. So I'll do it one more time.
No, I'd like to keep it with that. I'd like to keep it with that, the half recited, half read, because I think it would be interesting to hear, for people to maybe try and guess at what point do you pick up the page, because I think it can be heard. I think it can be heard where the words are not coming from your body. They're coming more from the page or from...
Well, I want to do it again then, and have them coming from my body.
Do you want to have the whole thing coming from your body?
I don't know if it's 4 a.m, but it's just that sort of performance concerned. Might be getting the words wrong.
Yeah, I mean, don't worry about that, because I'll put a link for the whole poem. People can get
it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so one more time here. He said, "It doesn't look good." He said, "It looks bad, in fact, real bad." He said, "I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting." I said, "I'm glad. I wouldn't want to know about there being any more than that." He said, "Are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help? When you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms, do you stop and ask for understanding in those moments?" I said, "Not yet, but I intend to start today." he said, "I'm real sorry. I wish I had some other kind of news to give you." I said, "Amen." And he said something else I didn't catch. And not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, or me to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. It was then that I jumped up and shook the hand of this man who had just given me something that no one else on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, habit being so strong.
Thanks. So as you were saying, you have a doctor who is really reading out a death sentence,
mm-hmm,
to this man.
Well, this is one reason I like to use this poem when I'm teaching. Not that the people I'm teaching are often giving people terminal diagnoses, because that's not their job, because I work in complementary therapy. But what point do you shift as the therapist from your own personal response to a situation to what is the language you need to be using in order to make this as useful as possible for the other person, the patient, the person who's suffering here? And immediately in the next line he does shift in the most interesting and powerful way.
Which line is that?
Or very soon he says, "Are you a religious man?"
Uh-huh.
And his ability there, as an old school kind of doctor, to shift the ground from the medical discussion, in which he suddenly is powerless as a medical man to do anything really, to something else, an area in which he feels maybe he can be of help, seems to be one of the key bits of this poem, sort of turning point, which I think when we're doing anything therapeutic with people, we need to be able to turn on a dime like that, to be able to know when the conversation is going to shift from the physical to the emotional to the mental to the spiritual. So he shifts it to the spiritual because he realizes there's no other place I can say anything useful from here.
My sense of when he does that shift is almost Carver, and maybe this is my projecting some of the not so great experiences I've had with general practitioners or medical people of any hue. My sense of this is Carver almost writing into this conversation something that he needs that was not necessarily said. I mean, I can't imagine a doctor saying, "Do you ever kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help when you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms? Do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments?" I mean, it's really, he's going into the transcendent here. I mean, that doesn't happen in your 10-minute sort of session with your GP, does it?
No. And of course, I agree. I have no idea what actually transpired when Raymond Carver was told. After having, he was told, you see, when he was an alcoholic, he was told by a doctor that he would only have a few more months to live if he carried on in this way. And he changed his way. He stopped drinking. And he got 10 years of new life, which were, in hindsight, as he put it, a great blessing. When he got this terminal diagnosis 10 years later, one of the amazingly positive things he did was to look back and say, "Well, I've had 10 great years." Mm. He wrote a poem called Gravy, in which he describes those 10 years as gravy. And so there's a strength here, which I admire. And of course, that's pure lyrical stuff. Doctors don't usually break into that transcendent lyricism in the surgery, and that's one of the sort of beguiling things about this poem. It's asking you to believe that, when obviously it's, as you say, it's much more likely that something deeply desired from within the poet himself.
Or perhaps I was wondering, maybe a satirical, some sort of caustic satirical edge that Carver is saying, wouldn't it be amazing that if this was the kind of conversation we could have when sitting with our medical assistants?
Sure, and of course in this age when there are a lot of different religions about, it might be politically incorrect or frowned upon for a doctor to say anything too specific along the lines of, are you a religious person? Which is another kind of almost nostalgic part of it. And that may well be a reason why doctors are quite tongue-tied these days, and there is I think that may be a reason why doctors find it pretty hard to know what to say these days when they have to give this kind of news.
Because when you recited it, I got the sense, and I wondered if this was your sense when you learnt it and sort of ingested it, of these two men being on sort of very level kind of pegging, that the doctor, yes, the doctor is delivering this awful news to him, but there is a real sense there of, you know, this could be me, you could be delivering this to me, I could be delivering this to you, there isn't a power dynamic going on. That was how it felt in your reading.
Well, I'm glad it sounded that way, because that for me is what this poem is about, or that's what I admire in the poem most, is the doctor's ability to shift to the I'm a human being and you're a human being level, rather than I'm a doctor and you're a patient level. And, as you say, to go into the, well, I won't be a doctor now, I'll be some kind of spiritual guru for you, and you can go on being a patient or a supplicant of some sort. That doesn't work either. What really works for me about this poem is the doctor realizes there is nowhere else to go except to be man-to-man here. It is a man-to-man language. Carver was, you know, very much into quite macho language. So there is a man-to-manness, an American man-to-manness.
And yet how macho or man-to-man is when you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms, do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments? That seems quite sensual.
Very. Mist blowing against your face and arms, yeah. The skin.
That seems more, I don't know, soul-to-soul than man-to-man.
Sure. Well, it is via the man-to-man connection that he gets to the soul-to-soul connection, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Right.
But I agree with you, yes, that the much more soft, feminine language there, lyrical language, it just stands out as something which really shouldn't be there if we're talking man-to-man.
Jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me.
Yeah. So there we have the big conundrum. What on earth is he talking about here? He leaves that as the paradoxical question.
So what has been given, do you think?
For me, it's in the previous couple of lines there where he says, not wanting to have to fully digest it, I just looked at him. Then there's a break in the line, I think, goes to the, I just looked at him, break, for a minute, as if we're taking our time there for that look to happen. I looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. And then there's no punctuation, there's no capital letter or anything, it's just, and he looked back, pause. It was then that I jumped up and shook the hand of this man who had just given me what no one else on earth had ever given me. And that language does sound like it was a good thing.
Yes.
Doesn't sound like it was a bad thing.
Yeah, it's not just the death sentence at that point.
And I just feel that in that eye-to-eye contact, I looked at him and he looked back, this soul-to-soul exchange takes place.
That we are both mortal creatures, and this time you're the one who's got the 32 polyps or whatever it is on your lung, but you know,
but
next
I can look you in the eye and still be fully present with you. And maybe that quality of being fully present, you know, it is a rare thing, and we only feel it at times of extremes. And so that's again another reason why I think this is really a powerful poem, and a poem worth remembering when you find yourself on one side or another of this kind of situation. Not necessarily being told that you have a terminal illness, but there are many things in life where it's so hard to stay fully present with someone as you are telling them something you wish you didn't have to say.
And to stay fully present with yourself, because he does sort of go somewhere else. He sort of dissociates, doesn't he, at some point?
Yeah. Well, this is absolutely typical of all the accounts you ever read, clinically speaking, of how people respond when they're told this. They stop listening. They just can't fully digest, as he says.
Yes.
Very much more. The brain doesn't stay on that level. So that's, you know, that's just absolutely accurate.
And at that point, it almost seems that the words have lost their usefulness, and what is useful, what is consoling, what is succor, is just that one-to-one unsaid understanding, I suppose.
Mm. And his surprise, which seems to be conveyed there in the way it's written, of jumping up and shaking. He didn't just sort of sidle out shaking hands.
Yes.
He actually jumped up and shook the hand of this man who had just given me something that no one else on earth had ever given me. The emphatic nature of that language suggests another skin-to-skin contact in that handshake, palm-to-palm, that...
So why do you think he's jumping up?
Well, that's good question. I mean, I was talking before about the eye contact being some form of real human connection.
So maybe it's almost too intimate as well. It's a real and profound moment of connection, but it also has a discomfort around it. It's because it's very intimate. It's very
Well, maybe it's a synthesis almost of that first bit you said. That sounds a little bit kind of ironic. Not yet, but I intend to start today. That is the language of a desperate man, or a man who's suddenly heard the powerful words of the guru, not sure if he can do all that stuff of kneeling down in forest groves, but certainly determined to start today and see how it goes. That slight tone of desperation there, then he goes into this blankness of shock. The mind is just blank. He can't even take in what the doctor's saying, and he realizes he doesn't even want to fully digest it. So you go from that, the first, to the second. And then there's the eye contact, which somehow, maybe through some alchemy, melds his own responses into a sense of action. I jumped up, shook the hands of this man, and then off I go to make sense of the rest of my life in the world that I have yet to live. Nowadays, especially in America, they talk about these kind of situations being a wake-up call. I was with a friend just the other day, a woman in her 60s who had a brain tumor and all been through the whole thing, and she was now traveling around the world and absolutely loving it. And she just said, this was just a wake-up call. In fact, she had been a doctor herself. A wake-up call for me to get starting to do the things I love to do. That's almost a cliche nowadays, that when Carver wrote this, it obviously was a kind of wake-up call for him.
And I suppose that the thing about a wake-up call is that the cliché only really exists in the eyes of other people. But if it's your wake-up call,
yeah,
there's nothing at all cliché.
Boy, you
about
wake
it.
Up, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's got that electric shock, yes, of jumping up with this sort of realization that, yeah, you know, maybe your days are truly numbered.
Yes, as indeed
they are for all of us.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think you got it there, the jumping up, the electric shock, the sense of reality is here again, which comes back to those words that I was quoting at the beginning about, you know, the bottom lineness of this experience somehow eventually gets to the point where you do feel more alive.
Amen. And thank you for doing that, Nick, at the very tail end of an 18-hour day. You'll be pleased to know that Mr. Pohl was recompensed handsomely with Bramley apples from the tree in my garden that you can maybe hear swishing in the background, or maybe not. Don't forget, if you've enjoyed our soul-to-soul chat, you can sign up for more of that via iTunes, or there's even a newsletter thingy which comes out now and then. If you'd like to read me something you love, you know where to find me. Take care. Bye.